Before YouTube, many folks who loved to put on a lot of makeup had to rely on their friends, books, and classes to get the knowledge they needed to develop extraordinary looks on their own. Thankfully, today, most folks can pick up some good tricks online and look as if Linda Evangelista had a beautiful alien baby. Today, our guest is YouTube makeup star Joseph Harwood, winner of Simon Cowell's You Generation reality contest to find the world's next video blogging superstar. Unfortunately, the show never fully got off the ground due to some controversy over crowning a gender nonconforming artist. Thankfully, it all worked out in the end. Listen as Joseph Harwood talks with us on how makeup for drag queens has changed over the past decade, her life in the UK with a royal baron, and living with mosaic syndrome, a genetic condition where males have an extra set of XX chromosomes, resulting in XXXY, resulting in gender nonconforming superpowers. I'm Fausto Fernos, and this is Feast of Fun. Feast of Fun is made possible because of the support of fierce, fabulous people just like you. Become a member and listen to all our podcasts from the past 14 years at feastoffun.com/plus. Or put a tip in our tip jar and make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate. Thank you for your support.
Hello.
Is this Joseph Harwood?
Hi. Yes, it is.
Joseph. It's Fausto Fernos from Feast of Fun. How are you?
This is so surreal. This is like literally, I listen to your Lady Bunny podcast so frequently. It's bizarre to hear you on the phone.
Just the Lady Bunny podcast? Would it make you more comfortable if I talked like this to you?
Well, possibly. No,
you know, there are
the
shows that we do on this podcast. There's more than just Lady Bunny.
I know. I also enjoy your cooking with drag queens.
Oh, you like it when I serve fish. Fresh salmon with a little tartar sauce on the side.
Yes, you do give a little bit more beef than fish.
Oh, I have to say to you, happy Mother's Day from the United States.
Yes, it's not actually Mother's Day here. It's actually that we're actually in Joseph Harwood's birthday month.
Oh.
So that's the national holiday we have over here.
You celebrate your birthday all month long?
I do. And I've decided to go backwards this year. I'm technically 27, but I want to go back to 25. So I've taken the year back instead of added it. Yes.
So you're not just redefining your gender, you're also redefining your age.
Well, I don't take any of it that seriously.
Well, congratulations on winning Simon Cowell's You Generation contest in 2013.
Thank you so much. That was such a bizarre kind of scenario for me to do because of the dynamic of the contest was ongoing. So it wasn't the same thing as on a TV show. It was something that was happening in real time, which was unique about the contest. But it's been literally like 4 years now since everything's happened. So it's been a wild ride since.
Well, for a lot of reality TV shows, usually they isolate the contestants away from their support network, their friends and family, and they give them a lot of challenges that are meant to test their character and their abilities. But for You Generation, it was a wide variety of different contestants, and you happen to be known for being a makeup artist at the time.
Yes, and they didn't isolate me from my friends or family. They isolated me from actually any press coverage because they wanted to basically, I think this is the setup, because obviously with all these reality shows that are owned by Psycho, which is Simon Cowell's company, I think they're kind of all set up to have an outward business model. So when you go on the X Factor in the UK show, you end up with a contract with Psycho. So that's what they expect to do. And they've already got their singles lined up and whatever to make money back. I think with You Gen, what they were really hoping for, because the only interview Simon really did was about the makeup category, is they were contractually bound to make the makeup the person, the winner out of all the different categories. So when I found out that Pixie Woo had chosen me as the winner, who are UK huge bloggers, they do reality TV, not reality TV, morning television, they do like guest production things. I think that they were disappointed that they didn't have the girl next door that was the winner and they had me. So they paid me off before the contest actually had even finished, which was a bit of a sad part for me looking back at it, because I should have got a lot more, I guess, attention and respect for it, because there's no one that's been gender nonconformist has ever won a reality contest like that. And the prize ended up being a lot more than winning Drag Race, because it was a payoff and no official prize and all this jazz.
So hold on a second. So did U Generation ever get posted onto the internet, or what? I'm kind of a little confused because I looked for it online and I couldn't find it.
No, they released the info that I'd won on Twitter, and then the contest never went any further with that. And I was then invited to go and sign with Gleam, which is a big management agency in the UK for people like Zoella and a lot of the kind of like teen branded bloggers here. And they just basically wanted me to look like a boy. And this is when I was looking like girl me every single day. So it was a bit of a kind of shock to my system to be questioned about it, because before then I'd had a career as a model since I was 15, and I worked like in female guys every day. And that was who I was. But when they started to question it, it was like the first time I'd ever felt like there was something wrong with it. And I started to like, oh my God, well, if they're questioning it, maybe I should question it. Is there something wrong with this? Am I going to have to continue in a different direction, because I'm never going to get past this point? And that's pretty much when I decided to kind of take a couple of years off. So that happened in 2014 and then into 2015. And then in 2016, I had a bit of a break.
Imagine you must have felt very disappointed that the competition sort of never went to its fullest potential, because they felt dismayed by them putting you as the winner.
Well, it was a bit of a weird one for me, because like I don't come from an affluent family at all. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a one bedroom basement flat. So I was more elevated that I could take that money and build a business, which I've been very successful with. And it was more of an important thing for me to take my mom to Paris and to buy me and my sister some makeup. Like we could share like designer makeup and stuff. And it was able to set the tone for what I wanted to do with other areas of my work. And I really kind of flipped it on its head, because I turned the opportunity into my own press release. And I used all the footage I had to propel me to my next step in my career. And I went off to do a lot more from that. But it was a bit disappointing looking back, because I think if they'd have been smart about it, I think with the movement that came out in 2015 with a lot of the LGBTQ conversation, they could have capitalized on it a lot more. So I don't think it was smart, but I guess it was everything's meant to happen for a reason. I don't think that was meant to be my introduction to the world. I think I had a bigger plan.
In a lot of ways, your being thrusted into this national stage happened before the trans explosion that Laverne Cox tended to tell.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, Violet Chachki getting crowned as winner of RuPaul's Drag Race. So the conversation on gender and sexual identity and sort of embracing and being very curious and being very excited about people who are nonconforming, we hadn't gotten there yet as a society.
Not at all. And it was before we'd entered this kind of conversation about trans people, that there's only one blueprint to do it. Because I just remember like growing up and being like all my older sisters in the scene were all drag queens. And there was a big kind of intersection between people that did drag and people that were androgynous, people that were transgender, people that actually wanted to fully transition, because there's so many different nuances in that, that I feel like we've only been allowed to see the A to B storyline. Whereas there's so many people that are still in question. There's so many people that don't want to fully transition. So many people like myself who have actually found out later in life that I've got XXXY chromosomes. So it's a different story for me entirely, because I have more of a natural kind of hormone level of someone that's transitioning anyway. So there's so many different stories that I think aren't being covered in the media, because there's been so much sensation about people going from one thing to the other, and look at the shock value of that. And it's kind of smudged out a lot of people that are still in the process of finding themselves, I think. So it was a bit of a weird one, because it was just before everyone started to get aware of the national conversation of this. And I think before that big Caitlyn Jenner interview with Katie Couric, is that her name?
Yeah.
One of the ones.
Well, it wasn't Katie. Katie Couric was the one who asked. Yeah, it was Diane Sawyer. Katie Couric was the one that asked them about their genitals, and it sounded like she was on to them.
Yes, that was Carmen Carrera, I think, right?
Yeah, it was Carmen Carrera. and Laverne Cox. Now, on your biography, it says that you live with XXXY as a genetic condition. What is that exactly?
Yeah, it's exactly the same as Caroline Cossey, who was the supermodel she was kind of like outed by the press in the 80s, I think. And then she came to prominence in the mid 90s and she went on all the talk shows in America and UK because she was in a Bond film. And it's actually more common than people realize that if people have a chromosomal abnormality, it's as common as 1 in 5,000. So we need to start kind of addressing the why. I think that's the part of the conversation that's never, ever mentioned. And I don't know if it's because a lot of the trans women that are just in the presence of the media just don't have the same experience.
Or access to genetic testing. I mean, a lot of Americans don't have access to healthcare, let alone the luxury of having their chromosomes mapped out like that.
Sure, but when I think there is a bit of a thing with Klinefelter syndrome, which is when you're just XXY, because one of the people I started on YouTube with, and I started on a channel 10 years ago now called Five Awesome Trannies, and I wouldn't love to say that word, but that's the word that the channel was called. And it was like every single day of the week, there was a different person, and not everyone was a trans woman. There were some people that just wanted to explore the option of femininity, and it wasn't so clean cut, but that was the name of the channel. And every single day, a different person would give a topical video about an issue that was going on. And this is like back in the day before social justice content was even happening and before you could even make money from YouTube. So you can set the scene a little bit more. But someone on the channel, I'm not going to give them away because I don't want to spill their tea, but they were diagnosed with Klinefelter very early on, and they were actually given testosterone as a child.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends that actually have gone through that. They identify as intersex. Is that but because a lot of people, yes, when they think about gender nonconformity, they have this sort of binary of cisgendered versus transgender. But in your circumstances, there's a lot more nuance there.
There is, because I think a lot of trans women can immediately get breast implants because they have breast tissue. And that's even before going on the hormones. And they're just never given the actual vetting process of finding out why that happened. And so many people have this, but just don't know about it. And I think that whenever you see the opposition in these discussions about trans people's validity, you always see those comments that are like, well, this is unnatural. This is something that's a chosen. You're imposing a male version of femininity onto yourself in a sexist way. And I think that there's just not enough information there, because I don't know how it works in the US, but when you're actually going to the gender clinic here, they assess a 2-year file of your behavior, and they don't go into your chromosomes. They don't go into your blood works in the detail they should do, because it would give a lot more information about it. Like, there's so much like biology in this that causes people to have a mix up, but there's also things like diet, like all of our milk and dairy are full of hormones.
Well, I've been reading that, what is it, the normal levels of male testosterone levels have dropped like 300 points in the past 20 years. And I'm just kind of like, it's a bit alarming, I guess, because it's like there is toxicity in our environment that's messing with our hormones and our identities and our minds. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's something that we definitely should be concerned with. But concerning XXY, should we call it a syndrome or condition?
Well, it's technically called mosaic syndrome, but it doesn't really have a specific, it's individual. It's an individual circumstance. Like, it's to do with your secondary sexual characteristics, which are the characteristics you take on after puberty.
It sounds like your genealogist had a typo and just hit too many X's on the computer.
Oh no, it can go on and on and on. There's so many different variations of this. It's to do with the doubling of certain things. And
And you have 48 sets of chromosomes as opposed to what most people have, which is 46?
No, I have a double bond. There's actually a show in the UK actually that's coming on called Gender Quake. It's just starting in the UK. And there's another girl that's on that's got the same thing. So she's better if people wanted to look into it a little bit more, I would suggest watching that show, really, because she's going to talk about it a lot from what I understand through the process. But it's a very, very, very common thing that people just don't know about.
How does it manifest in your body? Because I was reading the Wikipedia entry for it, and it says that, like, your pinky curves inward, that you can be double jointed, and some people even consider it not necessarily a syndrome, but more of a mutation, like the X-Men, and giving you special powers, like bending your elbows in unusual ways.
Yes, I am very much an X-man. No, I don't even know. I think that person. We'll go with that one. I don't think that it's as, I think with Klinefelter syndrome, that's more of an obvious kind of, you can see a symptom list. Like, there's a lot of things with your height, and there's commonplace. But if you have the hormone levels that I have, you basically are the same as someone that's on their initial stage of hormone blockers and then estrogen or progesterone or whatever they're doing, whatever route they take. So it gave me the exact same thing as if someone was first in transition naturally. That's the best way I could put it. Yeah.
So and this is like what's happening in your teenage years.
Yeah.
So how did your family react to it? I mean, because they must have not been aware of it. They just thought they had a very gender nonconforming child in their presence.
Well, and no one in their bluest dreams would ever have clocked me as a boy growing up. I just looked like a girl. I just looked like a really tall girl. And I was quite overweight when I was like a younger teenager. And I remember when I got to like 14, I lost all the weight and I jumped up to 6'2". And I was just this skinny alien looking person. And no one ever questioned it. Like, I left the male gym class when I was 14. Joined the girls and never had an issue with it. And I think that
Your high school, your school system allowed you to change gender in your physical fitness in high school?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, they were the third worst school in the country, and half of our teachers left during our education. So it was a bit like a crazy kind of anarchist school in certain regards.
But so it had a very disorganized environment, and so that allowed them, so it allowed you to navigate through the system because they weren't paying much attention?
It was awful. And it became an academy about a couple of years after my younger sister left. So it was just a wild place. But all the girls just kind of embraced me. And when the teachers asked who I was, they just said, it's a new student. And then I just got on with things.
Were you worried that they were going to discover that, you know, that you had gone from the male class to a female class?
The guys were like doing these bizarre sports. They would like have to do like rugby in the mud, and I would just refuse to do it, and they were just like, okay, you can leave and sunbathe. They never asked me where I was.
You had a fabulous tan.
It was well, at the time I was trying to be a doll, so I was like paling myself out with white makeup at the time. I looked like a vampire, but it was a mess. But
was that part of your early attraction to putting on makeup? Because, you know, you're certainly like doing makeup tutorials early on YouTube, and you know, certainly like your first video was doing how to make yourself look like Linda Evangelista.
Yes, like back in the day, I actually did a lot of the first kind of contour tutorials because I was fascinated by Wei Bandy, who was Kevin Aucoin's assistant and iconic makeup artist that inspired Kevin Aucoin. So I then got Making Faces and all the Kevin Aucoin books, and I started to do tributes to Kevin and Wei and then Matthew Anderson, who was a big old idol and role model of mine. And then Matthew actually promoted my YouTube when Drag Race first started because he had been watching my videos and said, this is the closest thing that I do to Ru. If you guys wanted to know what we do with Ru, check out his YouTube. And then he came on board and helped direct my second channel, Perfect Androgyny. And he gave us a lot of inspiration for that and was very supportive of me throughout the beginning on my YouTube.
What exactly are makeup artist now, because Matthew Anderson has, I guess, retired and moved on from doing RuPaul's makeup, but other makeup artists are taking the helm. What exactly are they doing to RuPaul's face?
I think
because transforming from looking from a skinny old black man to this supermodel of the world.
I don't know. I don't want to critique what I think Raven does the makeup now, right? Because I think they're phenomenal. I just don't. I think when you're doing someone that's already got an iconic image, that's got a style to it, and you are so used to seeing that version of Rue, it's hard to see a new person do it. I know there's a different. Well, from my perspective, I can see the differences immediately because Matthew did a lot more softer transition between the colors, and all the undertones were golden, and the hair was always kind of like, it looked like it was moving when it was still, whereas Delta's kind of creates more like a sculptural kind of look. I think she does the wigs, so I think that the differences are kind of obvious because they're just getting used to Ru's face, but it's, I think they do a fantastic job. Sometimes it's not my taste. I do think that towards the end of when Matthew did Ru, it was just fantastic, but
that first year after Matthew left was definitely controversial with the fans, and You know, everywhere you went on the internet, people were like, I am very shook by RuPaul's makeup.
Yeah, and people were not happy with it.
Yeah.
They did some, they've got like a weird sort of thing. Whenever Ru's in the lighter colored wigs, I don't know if it's because they're using a lace that's the wrong color, but they are blurring out the lace front of the wigs. And it just looks so bizarre on HD.
It can't be easy being RuPaul and having your makeup scrutinized so much to the point that you're almost a little scared to experiment.
I think, honestly, at this point, he just cashed the check.
He's just not thinking too much about what other people...
I don't think so.
He really believes in that. If other people don't pay my bills, I don't pay them mine. But I'm guessing that maybe the people who are paying his bills might have something to say about his makeup.
It's hard, isn't it? Because the format of the contest judges other people and their makeup. So you have to be an example of what you're judging. But I don't know. I think the show is a fun show. It's not the be-all and end-all drag in the LGBTQ community. And it's definitely put it on the map, but it's put a certain version of it on the map.
Well, one thing that I've observed in the 10 years, in the decades since RuPaul's Drag Race came to be this juggernaut, is the way people think about makeup, they're very concerned with contouring. And if you look at early photos even of RuPaul, like, for example, in the film Tu Wong Fu, RuPaul really wasn't contouring as much then as she did today, even when she was working with Matthew Anderson back in the day. And
I noticed that a lot of queens didn't contour today.
All over the world, and even some of my coworkers, you know, who are cisgendered women, are very concerned with contouring and highlighting their face, you know, painting. And to explain to the listeners who don't understand what that means is, when you're using concealer, using a darker concealer to shape the shadows of your face and a lighter concealer to bring forward some parts of your face to give it a shape that you desire.
Well, I think Matthew did Rue when he was in the more commercial stuff. He actually didn't use contour because the less makeup, the more feminine Rue looked. Sure. So in the MAC advert, there's not actually a lot of contour, because if you have a chiseled face and you concentrate on darkening the bone structure that's there, it's actually a masculinizing technique, which is why when trans women start on the hormone process, their faces plump out a little bit more in different ways. So I think contour has become so popular because it's replicatable on anyone. Yeah. So when, and I think this is the genius of Trixie Mattel, because anyone could be a Trixie Mattel. That makeup is a mask. Do you know what I'm saying? Anyone could put that on. So I think people have cottoned on to this kind of uniform that anyone can put on despite their complexion, despite their features, and it can look like what they see on television. And I think those people that have done that, maybe people like Adore, who I love and I've done work with in the past, she came on with much more of a relatable wardrobe, things that you could buy maybe if you looked in your obvious stores. And I think people definitely like to look at queens that they can actually imitate easily, if you see what I'm saying. I think that's kind of the thing with contour. It's kind of like a uniform of everything. Like, back in the day when I actually started to learn how to do makeup, I was playing the early versions of The Sims. You know, like the Sims video games. Well, they had these things called skins, which is how, like, you could customize your character's face, and it would give a JPEG of the actual, the skin as like a flat thing, and it would show you all of the differences in tone as when the image was flat, like when the skin wasn't put on the 3D model or the face, but was just like a fat picture. So, not a fat picture, girl, a flat picture. So you could see a lot of the tones and a lot of the techniques. And that's when I really started to kind of like think, oh my God, like maybe I could do that to myself.
Well, a lot of people are unaware that like Trixie Mattel borrowed her makeup look, not necessarily from a Barbie doll, but from other kinds of dolls like Mexican marionette puppets, where the contouring is very severe. And even that very hard line that she goes from the edge of her mouth to her ears is meant to evoke a ventriloquist dummy, and where the jaw is hinged, you know. And so when I saw that, this is the interesting thing, is that here in Chicago, we saw that makeup for years and years and years. And there was kind of a quiet exchange between club kids and drag queens like Trixie Mattel, where they were trying to like create an illusion of bigger eyes. The idea that their like jaws were sort of hinged and their cheekbones mm-hmm. were popping out as if they were spray painted by a machine at a factory. Yeah. And so when Trixie finally went on RuPaul's Drag Race, it was sort of the mainstreaming of a makeup look that had developed amongst a small group of people here in Chicago for a good decade.
And I think it totally happens like that. Like all these like really kind of concentrated scenes develop their own look. And then when they go on television, like people forget where they actually came from, which is such an annoyance with this community, because we do forget to credit our inspirations a lot of the time. And a lot of people get smudged out. From my personal group of people I came onto YouTube with, one of my friends, Firex, actually, who I grew up with and we did the makeup videos back in the day, she passed away a couple of years ago. And I think so many people reference her makeup tutorials and styles to this day that it's sad for me to not see her being referenced as the genius she was with makeup, because it definitely came from a place of watching our content. Because you have to understand, like, when YouTube actually started, there wasn't a lot of content on the platform unless you were, like, looking for how-to books. There was literally a platform called How To, where they would do like fishing harpooning tutorials, but then occasionally a makeup tutorial. And the people that were LGBTQ that started doing beauty back then were really pioneers in it, because there wasn't the content there. There was people like Petra Lude, who's Misty Maven, the drag queen, who I don't see a lot of anymore, but is so influential to a lot of drag. And also Silicone Drop, who is from Sardinia, I think, and she is amazing. And before Fame, there was Silicone Drop, and that style came out of her YouTube 100%. And then I had my little part with the more natural looks and the more, I guess you would say, passable looks, which with the drawn on eyebrows and the specific style of contouring. And I think when we all did that at that era, and there wasn't a lot of other people doing it, it's sad to see that you don't hear about Petra Lode's tutorials inspiring these drag queens that started in 2015. You don't hear about Silicone Drop inspiring these drag queens, because they did learn it from these tutorials. It's not to be rude, or with all humility, that's where a lot of these girls got the ideas from.
So it's Silicone Drop, and the other one was Misty Miller?
No, Misty Maven, and she was Misty Petra Lode. Yeah, and these were like old school, 8 years ago tutorials. Like they were really, I think, quite influential in the modern version of drag. Because I think a lot of the older queens were like based on Doris Fish. They had all like the garage doors, and they weren't looking about these crazy, it was like a caricature of a woman. It wasn't necessarily meant to be as finessed. And then there was no resource to learn how to do this makeup. So people did definitely take inspiration from what they saw. And it's sad not to see them be referenced, because they are geniuses, the people that started.
Well, it is interesting how my makeup techniques have changed over the course of my lifetime. And certainly like, you know, early on, what we were doing in drag in 1989 was what we were taught in theater school. Right.
So
we did a little bit of contouring. But the idea is that if you got clocked with that contouring, game over, you know, and certainly you were trying to hide your beard by putting some red or orange to offset the blueness of the beard. Right?
Yeah.
And then something interesting happened in the early 90s. The United States got really fascinated with makeup from other cultures in Africa and Thailand and Asia and sort of the idea of, and certainly like that was kind of reached its climax with Julie Taymor's Lion King on Broadway.
Okay.
Yeah. And so a lot of us then with Club Kids Club Kids were sort of the idea of taking beauty and rejecting it by putting dots and gluing unusual objects onto our bodies and faces. And then this idea of treating your face as a canvas, and certainly like Krylon and Manic Panic pushing very unusual aqua colors and water, you know, bright day glow colors into the market, certainly had an influence. And so, you know, when I started dressing up in drag, it was really hard to find a neon pink wig, the kind that, let's say, Trixie Mattel wears today. Now it's very easy to find not only a million of those versions, but also a million versions stylized, you know, to make them look like a pageant queen. And so in a lot of ways, like today, we have this kind of paradox, right? We have all the choices, all the tools, we have the internet to research all these different looks, but if you look at all the drag queens, for example, from this season of RuPaul's Drag Race, they all have very much a very similar approach and philosophy in doing their makeup. There's not a lot of diversity there. And I kind of wanted not you to comment on why aren't we seeing more diversity since we have more tools to expand on that diversity?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, because like I remember even 10 years ago, like when I was still in school and trying to find pale makeup, you couldn't find a damn white makeup in like a Superdrug. You couldn't find like giant lashes, because MAC had just been bought by Estee Lauder. They were kind of the go-to for the extreme glitters and full coverages. They stopped doing them in all their retail stores. You could only get them in Pro in the UK. You couldn't get giant lashes, and you couldn't get all these amazing wigs. Like, oh my God, they were so expensive as well to get all these things back in the day. But when people do not have much, they dig deeper to be creative. And I think people are much more resourceful when they have less than when they have a smorgasbord of like options to do things with. And it's annoying to me that so many people that are too young enough, they're too young to actually involve themselves because of their age group and the demographic that VH1 pushes Drag Race to, they don't really know that in all of these, all this nightlife scene of the LGBTQ community, there's been so much variety in the way people look. To be passable was not normally a common thing. You would see that the most extreme differences. There was so many people in London, in all the clubs here, basically when I was a teenager and sneaking in, that just would never think about passing. They would never think about things like that. They'd wear tinsel, like all this crazy madness. I was going to swear. Am I allowed to curse?
Yes, of course. Okay. You know, to me, it fucking bothers me, though, that that it's, and it's, I guess this is a form of ageism, that a lot of these media companies like VH1 is sort of pushing a very narrow vision of what drag can be to a very narrow demographic. And I think young people in my, you know, when I was in my early 20s, we were very hungry and curious about the drag queens of the past. And thankfully, like someone like James Mansfield on YouTube is sort of doing a lot of important work in educating younger audiences into developing an appetite for their history and for different looks, and embracing drag queens that are over the age of 40. And I think that's really important to do that.
I love this series. It's a funny one, because like, I remember I wanted to have a finesse with my look. And this is actually something no one actually knows about. But when I was 13 and on MySpace, I actually reached out to Jackie B. And Jackie B at the time was doing all those hilarious Austin Young videos. Yeah. So I asked her what she did with her makeup, because I was so impressed with the way that her skin looked in photographs, because even having like smooth skin was like a foreign like concept to, I think, most people starting makeup back then. Mm-hmm. And she was kind enough to actually list all the products she used. And I doubt she knows who I am to this day, but I'm always grateful that she gave me that list of Coty powder and Max Factor pan stick and all that jazz. But
Jackie
B
was very much of a punk and sort of a rebel, and she was very interested in sort of bringing those elements of this aggressive warrior look into sort of a more mainstream approach.
But it was done well. There was no harsh edges. There was no smudgy blending. It was. Beat, which I loved about her. And also Nina Flowers was there, because like thinking about like the kind of environment, I started with the internet when MySpace had just begun, and like I was on MySpace back then and seeing all these people for the first time and thinking, my God, how do you get all this crazy makeup? But it's funny how all these trends kind of like educate people, but through the weirdest ways. Like Kabuki Starshine is such an influence in a lot of these new drag looks, and people don't even reference him. They might have seen his pictures on Tumblr, but they don't know that he is so instrumental in not just music videos, but the colorful makeup people do, the mermaid makeup looks with those 3D gills all over the face. Like, it's funny, and I think that more people from my generation need to start putting the pieces back together to actually say thank you to opening these doors, because then we can be as creative as we can today.
How do we encourage younger people to develop an appetite and curiosity for drag queens over the age of 40?
I think they just have to be exposed to them. I think if you're going to give a platform to someone that's been doing drag for 3 years, you should be giving a platform to someone that's been doing it for 30 years. 100%. I don't think it should be in a competition format, but certainly a showcase.
I think there's Drag Race can start by removing the ages off the contestants' names when they bring up the names like other shows do. You know, yeah, I think it's very like weird. It's like, imagine if Drag Race started putting their sexual identity and their race underneath their name. It's sort of like the same idea as putting their age. I think it's to me, it's one of the aspects of the show I find very, you know, unpleasant to say it nicely.
Well, Drag Race is such a weird show because it kind of does put the people's specifics under their names by the way they edit the characters, because like they always typecast people in certain ways that you expect the scenes to be cut in certain ways. And sometimes, like back when they had all those mirrored surfaces, you could see the bitch wasn't even responding. Like you could see her face not moving when they dubbed over the audio of what she was saying, and they set up these reads that never happened. And I just think like there needs to be less of a focus on competing with the way you look and the way you have created an outfit, because half of these girls pay for their outfits anyway. They don't do them. Half of them didn't start off doing makeup until 4 years ago. And I would just do a showcase of drag talent across the board. There's so many comedic queens that I think have been a little bit forgotten about because they were booking cabaret shows 10 years ago and they're not being given the platform, because you could book someone like a Miss Vanjie who was on for one day and became fabulous because of the way she exited. But she's going to get booked over a lot of these legends, really. And I think we need to remember that queer people don't have an expiry date. And I think that it's one of the rare kind of occupations where people get better with age. I think there totally needs to be like a platform where people can showcase all the craziness and all the genius that's been in drag for all these years.
That's such a beautiful, full way of putting it. Thank you so much for saying that.
Oh,
you know,
I talk a little
I just need a moment to sort of like let that soak in, because it's such an important thing to say that I feel like isn't really heard very much. And so many people are just so caught up in this pursuit of fame. Now, you've actually worked with a lot of these big names and done makeup for them. Is it a difficult challenge to do that? Like if you're putting on makeup on somebody like Francois Sagat or Alaska or Willem Belli, are they saying, hey, do whatever you want to, or they have a lot of restrictions on what you can do?
Well, I was actually in a partnership with a photographer who really wanted me to do my own thing on their faces. Because what's the point in booking a makeup artist for a drag queen? They've got their makeup sorted. That's part of the job.
Sure.
But he wanted me to capture them in a way that they hadn't been seen before. So I actually was asked to do a lot more than I did. I was asked to do Sharon when she started, and I was asked to do a lot of the contestants during her season and onwards.
Before and I chose her, to do, Sharon had her face worked on, or before or after?
Before.
Oh,
before. I didn't want to do a lot of them because I thought I wanted to do Jinx, and it ended up, I think, being her first album cover and all that jazz. Don't quote me on that, but I could be wrong where those ended up. I think that's the first. That's where they were used in the end. But she hadn't got good makeup when I agreed to do her makeup. And the reason why I said yes to doing her in Alaska is because they had never been seen with that feminine polish to them. So I only agreed to do the people that I thought I could bring on my own version of femininity, and it would look different from what they would actually do. So that's why I agreed to say yes to those. Willem contacted me years before my YouTube took off, and she was a huge fan of my work when I did this mermaid aesthetic. And I said, let's just do that, because she's always been so sweet and supportive to me. Milk, I think, started doing a lot of makeup from my tutorials, and he asked me to do his makeup, which I wasn't going to plan on doing. He's always been really respectful and kind to me. And Francois Sagat was just a really fun opportunity, and they wanted me to do like Dame, but I was like, no, let me just break it down and do like a really quick but simple femininity on him and show that difference between like his like Greek god body or whatever you call it with the softness of the face. So they were just like more art projects, really. And I'm really grateful that a lot of these queens trusted me to do their face.
Is there somebody that you would love to put on makeup on that you have, like, what would be an ideal for me, like an ideal guest on this podcast? And we're actually working to do it, is to get Cher. Cher's coming back.
Oh, wow.
To Chicago, I guess, to launch her new musical, The Cher Show, this summer.
Sure.
And we're like, Cher, come on the podcast. Who would you like to put on makeup on?
Well, this probably sounds a bit contradictory because we've spoken about a lot of makeup, but I love makeup and I love doing makeup on other people, but it was something that I fell into and wasn't something that I had an ambition to do. Like, I really wanted to be a creative director in a lot of areas. It wasn't specific to the makeup look. And if I can draw it on a piece of paper and get someone that's got more technical ability to do it, I'd rather come up with the concept for someone than do the physical makeup, because I get a little bit too in my own head with perfectionism. Mm. And sometimes it freaks me out a little bit and I don't feel as comfortable doing, like, an icon like Cher would be so intimidating to do. Like, but I would love to sketch her makeup out as I would like to see her and have someone that she was comfortable with doing it. I mean, doing all these Queens makeup was such a brilliant thing for me because it validated my work on YouTube, because a lot of people just thought, oh, she just does the videos on YouTube and she's part of this generation of people that doesn't know her history. She just wants to get the online fame. Whereas I really wanted a career and I really wanted to say, look, you can also do, it's important to get your name out there and do the social media thing, but also please remember that you have to have a full resume, because this is a moment. And once this moment is over, people are going to feel a little bit regretful from portraying these glamorous lifestyles that are set up mostly by brands to sell products. And they don't actually have an incredible experience to move forwards with. So it was always really important for me to get my education. I went to university to do a biochemistry master's. So I physically make makeup in the lab and I do a lot of creative direction for brands.
Hold on a second. So you can go into a lab and say, let's pull some of these chemicals, and instead of testing it on a rabbit's ass, you just slap it on your face.
Well, there's a few, you have to go through a few, you have to go through a few like boundaries to get your products out there. But I was trained to do that in the lab and I can speak the language of a biochemist. So I can come up with brands. And at the moment in the UK, you can buy one of my products in Waitrose, which is our like Whole Foods. And that's by Be Good. That's my Raspberry and White Chocolate Lip Balm, which has been a crowd favorite, best-selling wonder. And then also we've got a few more brands that I'm working with at the moment, as well as my own brand, which has been a long and arduous process to get out there.
So you got a makeup brand at Whole Foods.
Yes, it's fabulous. And they are a brilliant brand that I came on board with and developed this specific product. But I've also another one called Pure Potions that I'm working with at the moment. And they're an eczema vegan brand. So the story behind that brand was the girl was really sick with eczema and they made these more holistic treatments and ointments. And I've come on with some new cosmetics and we're in discussions at the moment about that. So there's a lot more behind the scenes that I do. And I'm working with a fragrance with Aaron Kobe and just lots of bits and bobs, really.
You know what I want to put out there, since you're sort of developing a lot of drag tools for people who have physical limitations?
Okay,
will somebody please develop a pair of high heel shoes that are comfortable? Is that a thing? Is that possible?
My heels are comfortable.
Even Alaska is wearing boots. Like, all these drag queens are crippled. You know, this is what killed Prince. Do you know Prince the Entertainer? He developed hip problems from the high heel boots that he wore.
I don't believe this. I think he levitated everywhere. I can't believe Prince walked.
So he wore these boots with high heel shoes basically built into them, and they threw out his hips, and that's part of the reason why Jackie Beat had her get her hips replaced.
And Jesus take the wheel.
Yeah, Jesus take the wheel. And so a lot of these people have a lot of problems, medical problems, a lot of drag queens do, because they wear high heel shoes. And I'm like, if somebody wants to make $1 million, develop a pair of high heel shoes that looks fierce, but it secretly is ergonomic.
Well, there is a secret, and it's fillers in your feet.
Oh my God. Couldn't do that.
This is the tea. A lot of dancers, you get the thick filler that they use like on the back of like wrinkly old cheekbones. You put them in the balls of your feet and it puts a padding in your actual foot.
To soak in the
shock. I know so many
girls
who've had this. Yes, because it stops you, like, you don't rely on your actual foot. You have that buoyancy of the filler kind of in between it.
We need to have a pumping party for dancers.
How?
That's actually something you can go see a doctor for. Like, you know, I want to be a sickening queen, but I just, you know, I think also it's a weight issue, but I don't know. When I was like in my early 20s, I had no problems wearing heels, and now I'm in my mid 40s and, you know, weigh over 200 pounds. it is. And, you know, I'm not seen as, you know, thick and juicy by the public, but when I dress up in drag, I'm definitely dressing for a thick and juicy girl.
Sure. Well, I don't know if it's just like, because I was wearing heels from the get-go. Yeah. I was always stealing my mother's heels. But I think a lot of queens walk on the back of their feet. They walk on like their heel, but they don't, you're meant to like walk on like the padding at the front.
The ball of your foot, yeah.
Yeah, like, and then it kind of diffuses your weight. I'm really scared now. Am I going to be like crippled and have to get a new hip or something?
That's what I'm saying. It's like, we need to think about ourselves in the long term, you know, not just this, like, let's get on Drag Race, make $100,000 in the next year. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. Miss Vanjie's going to make $100,000 this year.
You know? I'm going to talk to the Baron, my partner, about this. I'm going to find out because he's an executive at Fenty. And he's doing the Rihanna makeup line last year, and he's doing the bits and bobs with her this year. But he's the guy to ask for all these products because he does all the crazy shit.
Yeah, I guess I heard that Fluvog is re-releasing, according to Lady Miss Keir, but, you know, take this with a grain of salt. Those platform shoes that Delight wore that are sort of flared heels.
They were fantastic.
They're very ergonomic. They're very comfortable shoes, high heel shoes to wear. And so Fluvog is re-releasing them this year.
Some of the Japanese brands, actually, they do these elegant gothic Lolita shoes that are really, really comfy. They're like kind of Victorian sort of styled shoes, but they're only in like tiny sizes. Like they're extra large is like a size 5, I think. But if they got those in like main sizes, it would be a wonder to all because they're very comfy.
Well, one type of beast that you are very concerned about is beasts of the sea. You work with UNICEF and Conservation.
That's the one.
Conservation, yes, marine biology. Yes. You work to raise awareness of animals in the sea and the children of the earth.
That's right. I was actually approached by Google to work with the United Nations on some projects. And originally, I think they wanted me to do the typical LGBTQ thing. But I think, like, oh, my God, every single person and their pet goat is an activist today. And it's just so insincere. It's coming from a place of, like, media opportunity, mm-hmm. I think, for a lot of them. I wanted to do something that was just totally out of my comfort zone. Because I think me doing me is visible and it's advocating for us already. So if I chose something else to do with them that I was really passionate about, which is things like marine biology and conservation and not littering, like, because there is a lot of things in the cosmetic industry that just we don't think about, like glitters.
Microbeads.
Get washed down the sea. Well, they've been banned in the UK, which is a brilliant start. But then there are so many things like the type of micas they use, which is their pigment powders that give the color. When they get flushed into the sea, they get absorbed by microorganisms that then get passed on to larger creatures. And it's a big cycle where it always ends up back to us. So if we just become a little bit more aware of what we're putting on our skin and maybe our diets, I'm a vegan. If you guys have never checked out my new website, check out josephharwood.com and you can find some of my vegan recipes because I've been vegan my entire life. Not through choice, actually. That was through health allergies and everything else. I grew up, couldn't eat in meat. I couldn't eat dairy as a baby, so I never have since. You can check out my recipes there. But it's just really important, I think, to now know, like, so much of our, like, new industry, it's just built on things that don't break down. Like, so many of these plastic products just do not go anywhere. And if you think you're going to be dumping them in the sea, they're going to end up on your plate somehow. It's always going
to
come back.
I would love for you to come to Chicago and get on Cooking with Drag Queens with us.
I would love to do that. I would absolutely love to do that. Can we do something, like, something spicy?
Yeah. What kind of food turns you on? I mean, spicy food.
Oh, my God. All food.
British folks love their Indian curries.
I do. I'm not too partial. I do like curries, but I'm not too partial. I like anything like any Latin food, Caribbean food, Mexican food. Yum, 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 yum. I'll have it all. I'm a big fan of
Jamaican jerk chicken, which it has a lot of Indian influences into the Caribbean cuisine.
Oh, yes. We love a jerk. And some like ackee and swordfish, but like vegan version. Oh, my God, yes.
Oh, did you hear that the first plastic bag has been found at the bottom of the world's deepest ocean trench? So they found
Lady Bunny dispose of it?
36
a colostomy bag.
3,600 feet below the sea, they found Lady Bunny's colostomy bag inside the Mariana Trench.
Sea creatures.
That's a good drag name.
Oh, terrible.
Mariana Trench.
Yes.
You know, that's a concern. I only use biodegradable glitter on my face.
There is so many things you can do now, whereas like I think one of the things that a lot of people, I live in Brighton, which is south of London by about an hour, and it's the only place in the UK that voted for green. So we are a really kind of eco-warrior kind of place to live, but we've started to stop using plastic straws. So a lot of things you can do if you're getting your Starbucks every day and you have a frappuccino with a straw is to bring your own straws and just be a little bit concerned about like carrying, like, as you said, non-degradable bags, like things you can keep to put your groceries in and things like that. There's so much you can do.
They've developed plastic bags made out of yucca root.
Yes, yes.
And so the plastic bags degrade, you know, in a week, basically. And they'll dissolve even with water.
I think that's brilliant. And they're stopping using a lot of polystyrene in place of maize. You can make like a, I don't know what you call it. Are they like Cheetos in the US? Is that what they're called?
I guess. I think the false eyelashes are made out of plastic, though. Aren't those?
Some are made from mink.
Oh, dear. So yes. Is drag and makeup inherently, is it possible to sort of be earth conscious?
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, like, not every drag queen needs to wear lashes. I'm not a queen that wears, not that I'm a drag queen, but I consider myself a queen. I don't wear lashes. I don't wear things like that. Like,
don't self-identify as a drag queen?
No, not at all. I don't have any of the skill set. I wouldn't want to shame the brand of drag by putting me in it. My God, me on a stage, not afraid to be seen. I got nervous at DragCon even doing a panel. My God, no.
Well, you did a panel, a pretty good panel with a bunch of other drag queens.
I was so scared, though. It was terrifying. I was terrified of that. I'm not very good in front of an audience, I don't think. I'll learn to. If I wanted to do it, I would do it well. But at the moment, it's not my... not something I've done or want to do.
What was the panel about that you did with the other drag queens at DragCon?
It was that one was about contour makeup? Du jour. Yeah, it was about makeup, but I wanted to ask the girls like a little bit more about makeup because I thought they were smart enough to have a different kind of conversation.
What was sort of the takeaway from that panel for those who weren't there?
Well, I asked them a little bit about like the process of applying makeup is quite meditative, and it's something that I think people skip over when they're kind of doing these like paint by numbers drag faces. Like, it's a real amazing thing to sit down in silence or with some good music and create a version of you that you want the world to see. It's a very kind of like ritualistic practice that I think is really great for people. I think that's why so many people have found makeup as a source of help with their gender dysphoria or whatnot, because it gives you that moment of peace, I guess you were saying sometimes. And I wanted to ask them a little bit more just about their inspirations and what they feel about makeup, not just like, oh, do you do an eyelash like this? Because we can find that information out from all the girls. There was Miss Fame, Kim Chi, and Trinity, and I think they've all got a little bit of makeup tutorial online already.
Who did you feel like was the most sort of zen of all the queens in that panel?
Zen?
Yeah, the most sort of chill mindset between Kim Chi, Trinity, and Miss Fame.
I think Trinity was very zen, and she was also very sweet. And I was a bit nervous backstage, and she was like, girl, you're going to be fine. And then we just did very well. But
she definitely was one of my favorite queens of this past, not this current season, but the past one, just for her sense of humor and just her.
Oh, no, you know? Trinity the Tuck. I got the name wrong.
Trinity the Tuck Kaler. There's Trinity K. Bonet.
That one.
Okay.
That one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was sweet. I want to meet the Trinity the Tuck, though. She's cool. I like her.
She's hilarious on social media.
Yes, I enjoy it. I like people that don't take themselves too seriously, too, and she comes across like that.
Yeah, and she's somebody who's been doing, like, drag and dressing up and for ages.
Yes, and that's the best thing, because you can see it when the queens have done it, because it was part of their natural thing. It wasn't something that was just going to get them likes on Instagram or whatnot. It was part of their journey anyway, which I think is so important.
I think one of the nicest things as a side effect of the success of RuPaul's Drag Race is other television shows that are popping up, like Dragula, for example, that are sort of showing a different facet of sort of, you know, playing with gender and identity.
Yeah, it'll be, I think that, again, because it's just a competition where you have to kind of compete against your sister, I'd love for just a little bit, we can see people come together and celebrate each other, because there's such this weird thing, especially in America, I think it's a little bit heightened, especially with your president at the moment, but people are very in their own teams, and instead of coming together and celebrating differences, they're used as ways to validate. And I think sometimes we forget that we need to also see the common ground between people, and Drag Race and Dragula in some regards, because of the setup of the competition, doesn't allow you to appreciate people individually. Like, people take teams and they think this person's more cooler or this person's more relatable. And you don't get a full spectrum of anyone from watching them on TV show anyway, because they're edited. So it would be cool to see, like, I don't know, like what's those old shows where they do like a singing bit then a comedic bit, and it was like a full show, a showcase of different people. It'd be awesome for someone to bring like a show like that out.
A variety show. Well, they kind of did that with All Stars, and I thought that was the most interesting episode.
Yes, but just that, none of the competition. You don't need to win anything but being on the stage.
Yeah, sort of the Gong Show but with drag queens.
Yes, wouldn't that be cool?
Part of it is, like, I think the general public has a very, you know, I think this is sort of internalized transphobia, is that the public really enjoys seeing these drag queens' egos get popped.
Yes, because they get taught that by the people that oppress them, I think, a lot of the times, because it's always the queer people that have got the harshest critiques. It's always queer people.
But not, you know, I mean, you're a rare exception, Joseph Haywood. You're absolutely sweet and lovely.
Thank you.
And so well-spoken and kind and generous. And I feel like, you know, you and I have dealt with a lot of people, and there's a lot of distressed lives involved in drag. And it's tough, you know. It's like my heart breaks with what happened with Tyra Sanchez and DragCon. It's like, it's,
yeah,
it, you know, I guess they increased the police presence this year at the drag con, and nothing really, thankfully, nothing came out of it. As far as
I know,
I've heard.
I don't know the full story of that, apart from a couple of social media posts I saw people share. But I think that drag for so many people is a way of defending themselves from their hardships. And you see the negative responses, but you don't see the reason why. And I think if so many people looked a little bit deeper, there probably would be another story there. And I think it's very difficult as well, because you guys in America are a little bit more, you're a bit racially aggravated at the moment, because there's so much conversation going on about police brutality. Thank God we need to start talking about systemic oppression. But yeah, at the same time, there's so many people with opinions that differ to that just don't give a lot of the queens of color a fair chance. And I think that she never got really the representation that a lot of the other queens that won the show did, because the audience was not as open to her from the get-go.
Sure.
And I think you can see that a little bit across the board in later seasons as things have gone on. But I'm not excusing what she said, but just trying to humanize her a little bit more.
Well, it's like we all can give and receive a little bit more kindness and empathy.
For sure.
You know, and certainly it's like, you know, that's part of my other jobs, is I'm just de-escalating a lot of conflicts all day long. And it's, you know, and one thing that I feel like, you know, for those who work in customer service, is like one key takeaway is that we can do a lot of good in the world on our everyday interactions with people just by making space and time to allow that person to speak their distress.
Absolutely. Just
even if we just don't agree with it, but just letting them be heard, and then reinforming that they're, you know, repeat their distress to them to make sure they're feeling like they're understood.
Yeah, it's so true. It's just like hearing people, isn't it? It's like, it's such a funny thing as well, because like, I think because I've given so much of a clinical how-to book online, I've never done a personal blog and I've never spoken about my family or my personal life throughout my entire career on YouTube. And I've always kind of looked different in each of my videos. I've never built a relationship with my audience in the same way that a lot of people with the same views that I have done, because I kind of wanted to hide myself because I am that vulnerable, sensitive person. And I do take things a little bit to heart. So I've always kind of cut off my personal side. So it's so funny when I get to do things like these and opportunities where I get to share a little bit about people, because they can be like, oh, she's always like calm. Because I'm definitely that girl too. I'm definitely misunderstood, I think, a few times. I've had experiences where people just don't see the full spectrum of my person.
Well, there's always going to be somebody who's going to hate you on social media and is going to be posting things. If you're successful, they're going to be posting anonymously to try to detract you. And to some degree, it's you know, there's very little you can do about that, you know, and certainly like it's even, you know, I think this is the distress that we're facing as Americans and as Westerners is that there's been, you know, we sort of think about astroturfing or, you know, people manipulating opinions on the internet with regards to Trump and Russia. But I would say that those techniques are being practiced by all kinds of organizations and institutions. And so, you know, when the opinion is coming anonymously towards you from a third party, we need to be very skeptical about that because of the fact that that probably is being tied to some type of manipulation, especially if it's tied to, you know, discouraging or dissuading you from a certain brand or source.
Sure. But there's also another layer to that, which is the big trick with online and social media is you're only exposed to things that the internet cache has identified as being of interest to you. So the people, if you think about these like hot topic issues that a lot of social justice people are talking about at the moment, even the trans discussion, the people that are commenting negatively are just the concentrated group of people that constantly search to do that. They're not an accurate portrayal of the rest of the world. Most people don't give a shit, which is sad, but it's the facts of the situation. But you're tricked into this bubble where you're only seeing similar ideas or similar or opposing ideas. You're really not getting a clear-cut kind of section of people.
Yeah, and that's part of the destruction of education to control the public. You know, it's like education is becoming familiar with ideas and perspectives that are not of your own making.
Yes, and there's so many scary videos I've seen where people across the country have repeated the same kind of soundbite on a news report. And it's like we really are being programmed in a way that's totally, totally, totally in plain sight. Yeah. And I think that the best thing we can do, like this is, I saw this really beautiful story actually about this lady who had got a little bit caught up, not that it's as serious as political stuff, but she got caught up face tuning herself and she became afraid to show her real self because her virtual self had become much more comforting to her than actually seeing what she actually looked like. And she went off and she actually spent a week volunteering with animals that had been rescued from situations where they'd been tested on and stuff. And she spent most of her time just doing something, giving back. And it brought back her sense of, I guess you would say, self-esteem or self-awareness, where she then realized that what she was a little bit more than just that image of her. And I think so many people forget, like, you can go off and do so much more. Like, you don't have to just sit there online and just debate with people. You can go out there and have, like, a fun time in, like, the village. Like, I live in a weird village outside of Brighton because it's, like, a seaside town here. But I live in the bit between the giant, like, it's called the Downs, and it's actually called the Devil's Dyke, which is like a giant green area where the devil apparently came down to earth or some nonsense. But it's so picturesque and kind of like we've got cornfields. Wait, and flowers.
They call it the devil went down to earth because it's so green and beautiful?
No, I don't know why they call it that. It's called the Devil's Dyke.
The Devil's Dyke is the name of the... That's the name of the town?
Yes, that's where I come from.
Wow, you sound like a character written out of a modern children's storybook.
Yes, that's me. I'm Mary Poppins, practically pervert in every way.
They're remaking Mary Poppins this year.
I've heard. And apparently, Angela Lansbury, this is what my partner said to me, allegedly, Mary Poppins was meant to be played by Angela Lansbury.
Yes,
and correct. She's going to be making a cameo in the new one.
What do you think about casting Emily Blunt?
She's intriguing. I don't think there is a lot of like actors that could do the part justice, but as we're in the age of reproductions, I hope she could do a good job.
Yeah, P.L. Travers was mortified by the Mary Poppins, the one she created, because you know in the books, Mary Poppins is very dark.
Yes,
it's not this cheery musical figure, and in fact, there's several Mary. There's an evil Mary Poppins. So the original Mary Poppins leaves and comes as this, you know, wicked witch who literally tortures the whole family, and Mary Poppins has to come in and save the family from the supernatural evil witch. It's very allegorical to The Wizard of Oz, right?
Yes. So many of these stories come from that place, though. Like someone told me this, and I'm still going to cling on to it because I like the idea of it, but I don't know if it's true or not. But The Little Mermaid, apparently, Hans Christian Andersen wrote it about trying to attain a straight guy. And the original version where they cut his hair off as the Little Mermaid was because the sisters were trying to make him into a boy. He wanted to transition. Now, I don't know if this is true or not, but I like the idea because so many trans people like, identify with the mermaid character.
I think definitely the Little Mermaid is a trans allegorical character, even if it wasn't intended. Certainly, yes. Like in the book, one of the most important aspects of it is when she gains legs, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, and she walks on land. It is devastating for her because of the pain. And a lot of people who get, you know, any kind of surgery, can be very difficult and painful just because of the fact that you're modifying your body and going through something so invasive.
Absolutely.
And ultimately, she does not get the love from Prince Eric.
No.
And she dies and she turns into the foam into the sea.
And thank God that's not the story for trans people today.
Well, you know, and I think as LGBT people, I think we're very attracted to tragedy and lost love. And, you know, we're some of the world's greatest musicians and artists and storytellers. And part of that is because we live sometimes in a cruel and heartless world. And we exist to bring more love and more kindness and generosity. And it's always something to keep in mind when we feel like we're not getting the love we need from our own community. It's part of it is that, you know, we're the ones who need to be giving that love out, and even when we don't receive it.
Do you think, like, with the kind of perception of the extremist cis straight people that don't give LGBTQ people even a time of day or a chance, how would we tell them that? How would we make those people see us like that? Because this is the thing that I'm always coming to terms with when I read, because I always like to know what the enemy is thinking, quote unquote, not that I consider people to be the enemy, but I think it's always really valuable to look at like the negative comments in some regards of these very important debates, because you get to see into the mindset of people. And I always come back to this conclusion that if people just saw you humanized and they just saw you without leading with labels, they would relate on some level to you a little bit more than some of the campaigns that are going on with visibility and some of the campaigns that a lot of people like Stonewall in the UK or GLAAD in the US are doing. Because I think the way that people really connect with you is just relating to you on those basic levels. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the part that I think we need to focus on doing next. Like, how do we move this conversation to the next level? And I think that we have these so in-house discussions that get taken out of context. Like, so many straight people don't even like the word cis at the moment. It's like, well, no, honey, we're not calling you a name. We're just describing you as something that we're not. And there's so much of this that needs to go on to the mainstream that I think would just give someone just more of an understanding of all of that positive and all the brilliant attributes about us and how we can kind of just lose the labels to become equal.
There's a little bit of you and me and everything LGBT. We all have a shared experience of not being at peace with who we are.
Yeah.
And we all have the deep ability and capacity to love each other.
Yes.
And love someone who we are not supposed to love.
Sure.
And I think, you know, in working, because I work with some people who come to me and they're just like, they're hardcore Trump supporters.
Sure.
And at first I'm kind of going, this person is probably an asshole. it's rude. It's pushy. And some of them are that. But some other people are your sweet, lovely old grandma and grandpa who have been isolated because of age or the world that we live in, and they have nothing and no one else to turn to other than these hateful churches and these hateful news channels. And it's very telling that Russian propagandists, you know, spent millions of dollars last year to promote content to try to destabilize the United States that was meant to be divisive based on age, race, sexual identity, gender, but especially race, was being used to divide us as the West. And why does Russia want to divide the West? Because it stands to gain economic power. That's part of the reason why Trump pulled out of the Iran deal. Not because there's no logical reason, there was nothing to gain from doing that, but because it destabilizes the West. And as a consequence, Russia makes more money because the price of oil goes up.
Yes. But I think that the problem, like, it's very hard for me because I think when you look at the outside, like, I don't have the viewpoint of England that the rest of the world has, because I'm in the middle of the programming, if you will. Sure. I'm the person that's seeing all the advertisements for all this stuff. But when you look objectively at people in the US, there's so many people that voted for Trump who, and I would say the clear majority of people that voted for Trump, they're just oblivious. They're not the I think the caricature of a Trump supporter is stopping people coming together on equal ground in some regards. Like, I've actually spoken on Twitter back, I think, when Trump was still campaigning, and I was like, I'm as far left as you can probably go in terms of my political alignment. But how can you... Some of these things are quite scary with the Democratic Party because of the funding to place certain people. Where is this? Is both sides of the coin great? Like, is both sides of the coin?
I think when we start weighing things as a binary and it's us, you know, us versus them, I think that's ultimately what's giving these very narrow-minded regressive forces power. And,
exactly.
And this idea, and conversely, the idea that both political parties are the same is also giving a regressive force power because of the fact that it disenfranchises us. It makes us lose hope and passion and desire to leave the house, to go vote, to go organize.
That's true, but I think you should be able to critique.
That's where I deeply disagree with Lady Bunny, and I feel like she's very misinformed on that aspect, is this idea that both political parties are the same, or that, you know, just because the Democratic Party has racists and has warmongers and is very deeply influenced by corporate money and is not as progressive as we need it to be, that the idea that both political parties are the same is still not... doesn't ring true. And the consequence of embracing that idea means that someone like Trump and someone like Putin gets to have more of a voice and more of a say in what the world is today.
I totally agree. And I'm not in any way sympathizing with Trump or the values of the Republican Party by any means. I think we need to be able to fairly critique both sides equally though.
Of course.
And sometimes I think we forget that the blueprint of not just in America, but in obviously the UK as well, the leaders of our country, their blueprint is to uphold white supremacy in whatever way you cut it. It can become more tolerant and it can evolve into something different. But at the moment, there's still so much wrong with the system that it's impossible to really... Like, you have to cut the whole thing apart and reassemble it in a way that's going to make sense for everyone, because there's so many people, like, even I think one of the things that I've seen crop up constantly with Hillary Clinton when she was campaigning was the calling people of color super predators and making those bills in the 80s that actually divided a lot of black families. Now, I understand that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. She's not the ideal candidate, but as a consequence is that, you know, what we got instead was somebody who put in a lot of justices who aren't going to undo. They're undoing the Voting Rights Act. You know,
yes, they are.
For all of Hillary Clinton's racisms, you know, there are limitations to her desire to undo the Voting Rights Act, for example, to putting Supreme Court justices that are African American and progressive. And certainly, you know, because she said, and this is the thing, it's like we're being manipulated by the social media that's being funded by these regressive forces that want us to drive cars, consume oil, and raise the price of oil so Russia can get more money. And that's at the core of it all. Does this make more money for Russia by driving the price of oil up? Yes or no? That's what's going to drive policy for the next decade for us.
Sure. And I hope no one listens to this and think I'm in any way sympathizing with the Republican Party, because I'm sending love to all my American brothers and sisters and in-betweenies, because I'm watching what's going on from the outside.
I don't think that's what you're saying. I think that you have really serious and very reasonable questions and concerns, and those need to be addressed.
Yes. It just is, I would like to see so much more awareness of I feel like everyone is reading from the same hymn sheet, and I would like people to come on board that have different opinions just so the conversation gets started. It's like some of these things that I will never understand about American culture. I remember the first time I went to America, I was flown to Dallas with Patrick Starr and Manny MUA when we were all with the same management team. Yeah. And I went to the airport and I phoned up the taxi and I was like, hi, can I please call a taxi? I need to go to a cash machine and I'm going to the Renaissance Hotel. And the woman on the phone was like, I'm sorry, what is this? Like, it was like speaking a different language. There's so much that I do not understand, like the way people speak, their growing up in schools is totally different. Like, I'm fascinated by American culture, though, I have to be honest.
We're all human beings, and we're all searching for love and embracing and acceptance. And we all want to live exciting lives, too, full of glamorous and... Thank you so much for bringing more glamour and more beauty into the world with teaching countless hundreds of thousands and millions of people how to put on makeup.
40 million as of this week.
40 million people have learned how to beat their face up to look like a princess.
Isn't that insane? Well, technically a baroness.
You're trying to actually become part of British royalty.
No, my partner's a baron. We've got a museum in Kensington. He's the ancestor of the artist Frederick Leighton.
What exactly is a baron for? Because that just sounds like, you know, a comic book character or something to us, you know.
Okay, so the story is he was a baronetta, which is one of the ranks of nobility. So you have a baronetta, you have a baron, you have duke and all these things and marchesa and then you have prince and then king and empress or whatever. But his ancestor was just a baronetta. And I always joke on social media that I married a prince because I think it's just such a fabulous thing. But we do technically have a museum in Kensington and it's it'll be intriguing. It'll be an intriguing future. I'm enjoying myself.
Wait, is the museum for you and your husband?
No, it's open to the public. It's like an art thing because he was a famous artist at the time. And it's just been a
bizarre thing. What's your husband's name?
Like, I'm not going to give him away. Well, why'd you bring him up? Questioning.
So he's actually a public figure.
I like
figure,
to boast about him.
But you want to boast about it but not identify him.
Yes, he's behind the scenes Illuminati. We have to keep the behind the scenes. And every single time I post something on Twitter, I get told off. So I'm like,
your husband is listening and says, Joseph, keep my name out of your mouth.
Yes, he's like, oh my God, why is she talking about me again? Jesus, take the wheel. Stop the bitch now.
Well, so, you know, I think a lot of drag queens would do themselves a world of good to watch the Netflix series, The Queen. Just because of this idea that, because we're all in positions of leadership to some degree, even if we don't want to be. And I'm very, you know, I don't know if this reflects the real life Queen Elizabeth, but the character that's portrayed in that series on Netflix is somebody who has a very humanitarian, very complicated way of looking at leadership and royalty. And I think we as entertainers and as people who want to love and inspire our own audience and our communities can learn a lot about what that character in that Netflix series did in overcoming and embracing her royal role that was thrust upon her.
Yes, it's a funny thing because I think in the last few years there's been a movement to secure the Queen's legacy because she's totally built this perception that she's stayed in the position of queen so that her family can have as long a time as possible without having that responsibility. And I think that she's come across very well, but she's a divisive character in England. I think that it's kind of like used sometimes as a distraction. I think some people perceive it as that when we're talking about the royals, and especially with the new royal wedding, there's so much like... There was just recently a week of series about the various royals on television here. And there was, I can't remember, what's the woman's name that Prince Charles is with? The one that he cheated on Diana with?
Oh, Camilla Parker Boyles.
Camilla. There was like this, television.
Her highness.
Yes.
Sorry. She loves to ride horses, not because she looks like one.
Not because she looks like one, but they tried to do this like television show where they kind of portrayed her as this like tragic love story. And I was like, girl, you cannot read the temperature of the country if you're trying to make that happen, because people love Diana too much to do that madness. Like, Diana was like the most beloved. And I think the Queen's mother was the most beloved as well.
Well, it's interesting that Queen Elizabeth and Princess Diana butted heads in real life so much. Because they, mm-hmm. of all the royals, at least to my knowledge, they're the most similar in personality and temperament, and this desire to sort of humanize this mystic character of the throne.
I wouldn't hesitate a guess, but some people say the Queen is a lizard in disguise that eats children. I could possibly someone being my father, and I just spent a 3-hour drive to get my laser hair removal with him, explaining to me how the royals are actually reptilian shape-shifting aliens. So I've got a lot of incoming craziness.
They did a study about people with conspiracy theories, and one surprising result is that they're surprisingly well-organized in their thought structures. And
yes.
Well, people who believe in conspiracy theories that the Earth is flat, believe in UFOs, yeah. that lizards are controlling us, is that there's a singular malevolent force, not a wide variety of forces, that is trying to undo humanity. And they're very,
wow.
that malevolent force is very egalitarian in its destruction. It's not like singling. You would think that people who have embraced conspiracy theories are usually saying, well, they're trying to undo white people, or, you know, they're actually like the lizards people are trying to hurt all of humanity, or the
yes.
Illuminati is are trying
bizarre.
To, you
know. My mm-hmm. dad talks in like some sort of weird, bizarre slang. So he refers to them as the nutties, which is a very like trying to have this conversation with my father is like, my God, I just think he has too much time on his hands. But that explains the apple doesn't come far from the tree,
sure.
does it?
Well, you know, my father was into he was a theosophist.
Okay.
Which is somebody who weighs equally all the world's religions and
yes.
Considers him the scholar of every flight of fancy that humanity's had. So my father
right.
was into transcendental meditation, past life regressions, Tai Chi, UFO, you name it. He knew about it. He had read books about it. He organized conferences about it in the last decade of his life. And, and he even was like saying that he was a descendant of an Egyptian hieroglyph artist. And part of
wow.
this was, and one thing that held in common is that he had a lot of regret, a lot of lament in his life, even though he did extraordinary things for his culture and his people in Puerto Rico. He raised two families, four sets of kids in two families. And, you know, in a lot of ways, he still was deeply a very unhappy man and felt very much like he had not lived his best life as possible. And so
he was very busy.
He was busy with
amazing.
All the kids, right? So when
yes.
one thing that my dad did in the, you know, decade when we were children, it was prepare us for his death. And the way he would prepare us for his death was to walk through us to what he thought his funeral would be like. It was a very grim conversation over McDonald's, right?
Oh my gosh.
So he's
McDonald's.
We're getting McDonald's. We're getting, you know, a burger and fries and an ice cream and a soda and stuff like that. And as I'm eating, he's telling me, you know, the day I die, this is what my body will look like to you. This is what you're going to see. And just know that my spirit is off on the universities at Mars studying to become a more enlightened species.
That will put you off your happy meal, won't it?
And my sister and I were like, you know, with food in our mouths, looking at ourselves like, is he for real?
Oh my goodness.
And I got to tell you, when my father did finally pass away in 2006, It was a very, it was in a lot of ways, I was very grateful for the fact that he sort of psychologically prepared me for that moment.
Oh, well, that's a sweet thing. It's so sad when family members die, but it's a real, it is very kind of morbid, but it's a very sensible approach because it's definitely going to happen.
We all go sooner or later, honey. It's really the measure of our lives is how much love we give and how much love we're able to share with others.
Absolutely. And I do have to say, actually, quickly, before the end of the podcast, thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this today, because I am a huge fan of the podcast, and I do listen all the time, and I've just got back to work, really, for the first time after taking a year and a half off, so it's a real privilege to have me on here.
Joseph Harwood, thank you so much for talking to us. I really enjoyed your sweetness and your kindness and your amazing adventures you've had so far. Where are you going from all this? Like, in, what's the next year hold for you?
Oh, I've got a lot coming out in the UK. I've just signed a new deal where I'm going to be doing a mini series where I learned to drive, which is coming, called Joseph Drives Us Crazy.
What?
You know, it's going to be intriguing. We'll have to wait and see how it folds.
This is a reality. Out. Where is this going to air?
It's going to be an internet thing. So we've just set up the basics of it at the moment. Whatever form it takes will come up crazy, but it's been on the cards for about a year now. And I've just been talking about building a house in France with the Baron, which is exciting. He asked to do that this week. So we're kind of figuring out what's going on with that one. And then with me, I have just launched a transformation series that I've been keeping on the back burner. Just to say thank you to everyone that was supporting my YouTube for so long. It's just to kind of tie up my YouTube work with a bow, if you will, because I love YouTube. I'm very grateful for it. But it was a tool to facilitate what I wanted to do elsewhere, and I wanted to move into different aspects of entertainment. And as I get confident in my skills, things will come out, but I've got a lot on the cards in that area.
Back when Mark is back from his secret project, and we'll talk about you learning how to drive.
Yay, and say hi from me, please. And I'll come do the cooking show as well.
I wish I could. I don't know. There's no communication for 2 months.
Oh, my God. Is he in an asylum, a maximum security unit?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
I see. I'll ask no more questions then.
You can ask all the questions you want, and the speculation is wonderful, but I really am not allowed to confirm nor deny anything that people are saying. But
I see. Let's just say it's
extremely difficult for me and for our dog and our community here in Chicago. And it's, it just shows how much we love him and how much we miss him. And, you know, we look forward to seeing him back.
That would be fun when he's back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It will be.
All right.
Joseph, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse says hi.
Hi, Jesse. That's my sister's name. My God, if she thinks I'm calling her.
Take care, Joseph.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey, before you leave.
Okay.
What's the name of the city you live in? Is Dyke?
Brighton. Oh. Devil's Dyke is the village.
Okay, hold on a second. Let me add that to here. The village of
I sound like a lady bunny stalker in this video, and I also sound like I'm using crazy words. It's not meant to be in reference to lesbian. It just means bitch.
I love it. Liz in the what is Brighton considered? And
Brighton Hove is a city. It's a
in the city of Brighton, right? So it lives in the UK. In the city of Brighton, in the village of Devil's Dyke. Okay.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you so much, Joseph. And thanks for all the photos and giving us so much of your time. And really extraordinary.
That's story. Okay. Thank you for having me.
Take care, sweetheart.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Joseph Harwood lives in the UK, in the city of Brighton, in the village of Devil's Dyke. Check out Joseph's fabulous videos, vegan recipes, and products at josephhardwood.com. What do you guys think about today's podcast? let us know. Well, how do you think makeup has changed over the course of the last decade and the influence of YouTube and YouTube artists like Joseph Harwood have had on makeup artists like yourselves? Weigh in on our website, feastoffun.com. Remember, Feast of Fun is made possible because of generous support of fabulous people like you. Consider becoming a member and listen to all our shows with extraordinary artists, drag queens, and entertainers at feastoffun.com/plus, or make a one-time donation, put a little tip in our tip jar, more than just a tip, at feastoffun.com/donate. My name is Fausto Fernos. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.